When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The process of puberty is much more ungendered than it is gendered. It is really a transformation that goes across so many different categories, right? Physical, social, emotional, relational. It's an incredible gift to be able to learn about the bodies they're living in alongside with them. And our best advice there is to get curious and educate yourself in the exact same way they're educating themselves.
We talk about the flexibility required in caring for kids through this journey, because even with one kid, what worked last week probably won't work this week and definitely won't work next week. And we have to be really nimble and flexible in terms of like the different ways and handling stuff.
That was Kara Natterson and Vanessa Kroll Bennett on Psychologists Off the Clock.
We are four experts in psychology here to bring you cutting-edge and science-based ideas from psychology to help you flourish in your relationships, work, and health.
I'm Dr. Debbie Sorensen, a clinical psychologist practicing in Mile High, Denver, Colorado, and author of Act for Burnout, Act Daily Journal, and the Act Daily Card Deck.
From America's Heartland, I'm Dr. Emily Edlin, a clinical psychologist based in Chicago, Illinois, and author of Autonomy Supportive Parenting.
Calling in from Vienna, Austria, I'm Michael Herold, ACT coach, confidence trainer, and author of an upcoming book on being a better conversationalist and making friends.
And from coastal New England, I'm Dr. Jill Stoddard, author of Be Mighty, The Big Book of ACT Metaphors, and Imposter No More.
We hope you take what you learn here to build a rich and meaningful life.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock.
Small behaviors can make a big difference in our health and well-being. Most of us work so many hours each week that we should think about how our work habits affect our bodies. Being able to stand sometimes while I work has made a huge difference for me. Uplift Desks has created high-quality office furniture designed to help you work better and live healthier. My Uplift standing desk allows me to easily transition from sitting to standing while I work with just the push of a button. I feel so much better than when I sit all day, and it helps me recharge to change positions when I get tired in the afternoon. In addition to standing desks, Uplift offers ergonomic office seating, storage systems, even walking treadmills for your desk. You can get free shipping with no hassles, free 30-day returns and return shipping, and a 15-year warranty. Remember, by supporting our sponsors, you're supporting the podcast. Visit upliftdesk.com/POTC for 5% off your order. That's UPLIFT desk.com/POTC to get 5% off your entire order.
We all know there are trade-offs in life, like having to drive a little further to save on gas or groceries. But when it comes to your health, you shouldn't have to trade off. So don't go back to that one doctor who's always late and rushes through your appointment just because they're close by or they take your slightly sketchy insurance. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. You can search by location, availability, insurance, literally no trade-offs here, because with ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. My kid's pediatrician is retiring this summer, so you can bet I will be using ZocDoc to find someone new who we all love and trust. So go to ZocDoc.com/POTC and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/POTC. ZocDoc.com/POTC.
Hi, everybody. It's Emily here, and I am talking to Jill today about my conversation all about puberty with Kara Natterson and Vanessa Kroll Bennett, talking about their new book. So Jill, I am so curious to hear what it was like for you as a mother to listen to a whole hour about puberty.
Well, this was one of those interviews where when you said, you know, we're running out of time or something like that, I was like, no, I need more. It went by so fast. It was such a good interview. I loved Vanessa and Cara. They are not just a wealth of information, but just funny and fun and likable. It was such a good interview. I got so much out of it. You know, this is one of the books I think I have to run out and buy. I have a daughter who is turning 12 in the spring and a son who's turning 10. So this is exactly right, the right time. Yep. Yep. And there were just so many amazing nuggets in here that you talked about. And I think what struck me most is I felt very validated through the whole conversation, which happens a lot in your parenting interviews. And you talked about this with them, that you felt the same way when you were reading the book, and they did a nice job of being validating during the interview. And so that especially felt prominent for me when you were talking about mood swings. And I had this aha moment. In fact, I had several aha moments as you were talking, and I had this aha moment, and it's not that deep, but it was for me, that, you know, you talk about mood swings, they had lots of helpful ideas. And what it did for me is it reminded me to not take this personally, that if my daughter is being unkind, what I realize is it activates worry in me that this means she's going to grow into a jerky human, right? That like our jobs as parents are to raise kind adults, you know? And, but that's my stuff, right? That is not about her. What's going on for her is she's just at the mercy of her hormones.
Yeah.
And she's lashing out because she can't help it.
Right.
And she doesn't need me to be yelling at her for being a jerk, right? Like she needs validation and empathy and someone to help provide a safe and soothing atmosphere. And, you know, it's like, I know that, but I just need to be reminded of it, right? Like as parents, we're also human beings who have our own reactions to things. And so I just found that really useful. And I'm going to have to listen to the interview again and again and read the book.
Another book for your bookshelf. I mean, that was one of my favorite parts of the book and talking to them is that warmth and humor and being really realistic. And one thing they say is when you mess up as the parent in navigating all of this, when we're all going to want do-overs, and do-overs are just fine. And I love that part. And throughout their book, they give very specific tips and strategies for how to talk about these tricky subjects. I mean, and we could barely scratch the surface, but from everything from how to talk to your child about they stink and they need to use better hygiene to sleep and risky behaviors and friendships. I mean, they cover the gamut.
Yeah. Yeah. Even in this interview, they gave several really specific suggestions for exactly what to say when you're broaching certain topics like sex or other sorts of areas. And I need that. You know, you can tell me what needs to be done. And I always find myself thinking, but how? What exactly do I say? I don't know how to do this. And they really did a great job of that.
They did. I really appreciated their blend too of Cara as a pediatrician. And so there's a lot of biology in the book, which it doesn't sound that appealing, but it actually makes so much more sense of what is going on in the brain. And it gave me more empathy for what my kids are going through to understand just like the chemical, hormonal processes affecting how they're acting, and that their mood is not a character trait.
Yes.
You know, that we're somehow not parenting well enough. No, we are a safe space for them to have these outbursts that they can't have everywhere and they shouldn't have everywhere. So can we be that container for them with that understanding of everything that's swirling in their bodies?
Yeah, absolutely. And even though we've all been through puberty, it's been a very long time. And one of the other things you talk about is how much it has changed since those olden days where we middle-aged people, what we parents went through it. It starts earlier, it lasts longer. And so we need to really kind of, I guess, have that much more empathy for what these kids are going through, that they're having to deal with this at a younger time and deal with it for a longer amount of time. And they really need us to be that harbor and a very stormy storm.
And also grace for ourselves that we're doing this for the first time too. And I mean, I'll share with you, Jill, that parenting my second going through puberty has been easier because my first sort of broke me in to the Wild West. And now it's not so foreign. So it does get easier.
It does get easier.
And I'm always learning. We're always learning.
We're always learning. Well, and of course, one kid, you know, just when you think you've got it figured out with one, you get a completely different human and need to do things differently. And I liked that you talked about that too. What is right today might be wrong tomorrow, or what's right for this kid might be wrong for this other kid. And that's okay. Like, we're all fumbling through this. We're not going to get it perfectly. And I also think it's important, you know, to have podcast interviews like this and for all of us as parents to be talking about this and support one another through it and even encourage our kids to be talking about it. Like, I love that my daughter and her friends, they do not hide their tampons.
Right.
They talk about when they have their periods and, you know, it's no longer this dirty little secret. And I think that that is growth that is incredible. And I'm so happy to see it. And that's a way they can support one another instead of feeling lonely and scared and some of the other
and ashamed,
emotions.
You know, I think
and ashamed.
A lot of this is removing shame from the process of growing up and becoming more full human beings in the world.
For sure. And there's also a really fun discussion about Takis. So listen to the end and you can learn about kids and puberty and Takis.
Takis make a feature appearance in this discussion. I hope everyone gets as much out of this as Jill and I did. I am here today with two incredible women who have made puberty their life's work. Kara Natterson, MD, is a pediatrician and New York Times bestselling author. Vanessa Kroll Bennett is a puberty educator and writer. Together, they host the Puberty Podcast, run Order of Magnitude, the leading brand dedicated to flipping puberty positive, and are co-authors of the best-selling This Is So Awkward, Modern Puberty Explained. Kara and Vanessa can be found on Instagram and TikTok at Spilling the Puberty. Perhaps their biggest cred, however, is that between them, they parent six teens. Welcome to Kara and Vanessa.
Thank you. I should clarify, we parent six teens in two different households across the country.
So you're not doing this together?
No, it sounds more impressive if we were actually doing it together with six of them under one roof, but no.
But no. Well, it's still impressive. So I actually wanted to start by sharing my stage of puberty parenting. And first, I will do what you do in the book, which is be very sensitive about how we use the terms boy and girl and gender identity. And so I will start with, when I talk about my kids, we actually live in a community that is quite affirming of gender diversity. We have a lot of open discussions about gender identity. And as of now, my kids identify as their genders assigned at birth. So just giving a caveat, just like you do in the book.
That was beautifully framed. I like the as of now.
Yes. So you never know. So I have two daughters, ages 14 and 12, and I feel actually pretty comfortable talking about most topics with them. I mean, I am a child psychologist. I am accustomed to uncomfortable topics, but I also have a 9-year-old son, and he is my baby and my only boy. So I have two strikes against me because I feel like I don't relate to his experience like I do with my daughters. And so the boy stuff feels more foreign to me, and he's my baby, right? He's like, if we start talking about it, it means he's growing up. And I know it sounds ridiculous. I'm a trained child mental health professional, but this is me being human. So I'm curious, in your many years of being puberty pros, what do you see as parents' biggest stumbling blocks?
So what I appreciate about what you just said, there's two parts to it. One, there is a grief for a lot of parents as their kids begin to grow up and transform and change. And the grief, I think, has a couple of parts to it. One is that just physically, they're not their delicious, yummy, milk-scented, you know, peach soft skin version of themselves anymore. So that's like the visceral reality of their being is not as yummy and delicious as it once was. It's smellier, stubblier.
So what are you even talking about? I have no idea.
Oilier, sweatier, right? So there's that grief. And then also there's the grief that's tied to a fear about kids getting older and what does it mean in terms of like being an adult or being sexual or being out in the world and independent. There's all of that grief, like we're losing our kids somehow and they'll never come back to us. And so I think your honesty and vulnerability in talking about that is really important because we hear that a lot from parents and we've really like to reassure them because not only do we do this work, but we also have kids all the way through that spectrum of ages and they do come back to you.
Yeah.
And they do come back in really yummy and delicious and meaningful ways. It looks different. It sounds different. It smells different, but it is really, really wonderful. So we do like to encourage parents who are like, dreading it and worried and feeling sad and abandoned and all of those big feelings that actually there's like really amazing things down the road for you.
I just want to jump though on the not having shared parts part of the question because this is a very common phenomena, as you can imagine, right? Because we have the parts we have and if we have children, there's about a 50-50 shot. They don't have the parts we have. So you keep good and large company. It's an incredible gift to be able to learn about the bodies they're living in alongside with them. And our best advice there is to get curious and educate yourself in the exact same way they're educating themselves. Read the books that they might read that are age appropriate to them to understand not just what's happening, but like actually what they're learning. What their understanding about their bodies. You know, talk to people in your life, physicians and other colleagues in mental health and consult amazing websites. We have a lot of resources in the book that can point you to places where you can learn about his body. But of course, as you know, and as we talk about all the time, the process of puberty is much more ungendered than it is gendered. It is really a transformation that goes across so many different categories, right? Physical, social, emotional, relational. And so the parts are just one little piece.
Yeah, that's a good reminder. Well, thank you both. That felt very validating. Which
I'm so glad to be able to do that.
Is a nice little preview of how your book feels for listeners. So hopefully it's inspiring to pick it up. You know, I thought it was really interesting when you talked about, even though there's a lot of shared experience with girls, it's more visible, like the early changes are more visible.
Yeah.
And when you started talking about the change for boys, meaning like a slight lengthening of the penis, and it was so funny because right in my head, I'm like, should I go check? And you then said, do not go check.
Even I didn't check. I was so tempted. I was so tempted.
I'm like, what's happening?
I mean, it's so unfair because girls' breast buds like stick out of everything. Like you could be wearing a down coat and you could see breast buds. And so everyone in the world knows that a girl's body is developing. But because penile and testicular growth are the first signs of male puberty and they're really slow and kids get really private right around that age.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what's happening unless, as Cara says, you have a nudist in your house who's decided to let the whole family know what's happening. But most of us with boys this age do not have nudists. And it's kind of a guessing game until the annual physical or checkup and the pediatrician will say, yep, here we are, or nope, Tanner stage one. And for some kids, that just goes right over them. They're like, oh, whatever, you know, like not paying attention. And for other kids, they really want to know, where am I? And what's the timeline?
Right. And how are they actually comparing with their peers and all of that?
That's right.
You know, a huge takeaway I got from your book that I really related to is how at least parts of puberty are so different these days compared to when we were kids. And I remember, I think it was my oldest 8-year visit when the doctor asked about signs of puberty, and I laughed. I thought she was joking, and she was not. And I also back then wrote my own blog post about, is 8 the new teenager? Because my daughter had these moods that I would have expected in a teenager. So talk more about what is different about today's.
I see how we made you feel validated. You're living exactly the typical timeline that we describe, and you've lived it for a while now. You've lived this timeline for several years. So what you've experienced is the average age of onset for puberty for girls is between 8 and 9, and for boys is between 9 and 10. Of course, there's a big range on either side of that. And puberty's not going any faster. It's right. It's actually going slower. It takes longer to hit the middle point than it did when we were going through it. And the middle point that we use is first period, which of course there's not exactly an analogous middle point for male puberty, but I think it's a fair way to at least mark it in females. And, you know, so what's happening? It's stretching, right? You've got kids that, you know, are occupying all different pieces of that big wide lane of puberty. And you're not even close to done in your house. You've got years to go in your house. So the data is remarkable. It is not new data. It is not new. These are studies from 2010, 2012. I mean, these are pieces of data that we're looking for more and more and more to come out over time, but it's been fairly consistent, I would say, over the last decade, when people look at starting points of puberty and what they're looking for, just to be super clear, breast budding in females, penile and testicular growth in males, and those mood swings because the sex hormones circulate around the brain.
Yep. So when we were growing up, we were starting later and it wasn't stretched out as long. Is that right?
Right. So if the kids start 2 to 3 years on average earlier than we did, but the first period, which was 12 and a half when we were going through puberty, and is now only moved 3 months on average earlier to 12 and a quarter. So the midpoint is now 3 to 4 years after the average onset. And then there's still lots of growth and development after a first period.
Right.
Or, you know, boys have lots of growth and development all the way through the nearly decade of puberty. So people, when we tell people like, oh, well, it's almost a decade, they're like, oh my God, as Par says, it's a special joy for everyone involved. But the way we like to put a positive spin on it is it means you're going to get really, really good at having lots of the thousands of conversations about body changes, emotional changes, social changes, everything involved in puberty. You're going to get so good at having those conversations, and you're going to get so good at taking do-overs when you mess up those conversations.
Well, and I like how you say when you mess up.
Yes, this is not an if situation. No.
And it was another thing I so appreciated throughout the book is you divide the chapters into the science. So you give us a great biology recap. I mean, I don't think I learned any of that in biology, or I don't remember any of it. So it was a really good review or new learning. And then you get into how do you actually talk to your kids about each topic? And within that, you're very forgiving. You know, you will flounder, right? And you always can come back for a do-over.
You know, I'm going to start by saying this is the benefit of having written a book with someone. If either one of us had written this book on our own, I don't think the forgiveness would have been as front and center. But when you write it with someone else and you're constantly in conversation about all of your own screw-ups and they're like, me too, and you have bonding sessions over how typical that is, it gives you permission to put it front and center in a way that when you're doing it solo, there's all this guilt and shame. And like that was all tossed out the window day one when we started podcasting. Forget even writing. Like, you know, we're all going to do this differently. We're all going to mess it up. The notion of perfection, bye-bye. Also, no one really relates to someone who's perfect. So you want to relate to your kids? Okay, show your warts and show your imperfections. You know, why do we love certain celebrities or certain public figures more than others? If you really drill down on what you love, it's probably the imperfections that are as attractive as the aspirations. So, you know, it's all in service to saying we are big believers in the do-over. We own messing up. Our children have become outstanding at telling us how we mess up and where we mess up. We have become better at saying, thank you for sharing, but maybe that wasn't the kindest way to deliver that information. But we're going to mess up. Also, by the way, the world looks nothing like it looked when we were doing this. So we're on a steep learning curve, which is, you know, I mean, how do you do it perfectly when this was not your lived experience?
Well, and there is no perfect, but what might be perfect one day with one kid is not the same another day with the same kid or a different kid.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about the flexibility required in caring for kids through this journey. Because even with one kid, what worked last week probably won't work this week and definitely won't work next week. And we have to be really nimble and flexible in terms of like the different ways into handling stuff. And then when you have more than one kid in a household and you're like, oh, I was so good at this with this kid. I'm going to be awesome at it with that kid. And they very quickly turn around and make it extremely clear that like, no.
That's not awesome.
It's not awesome. You got to find another way in. I am my own unique individual. We have our own unique relationship and chemistry and like time to get creative and resourceful because you cannot rest on your laurels.
Yes, that's a really good point. And I realized while reading your book how much I think I've had many more conversations with my oldest because, well, for one, she's my oldest. So I'm a little more focused on doing everything I'm supposed to do. But she's also more open and she comes to me and initiates conversations. So she's kind of made my job easy. And then I've realized, oh, my 12-year-old's not quite doing that. And I may be missing out on some important conversations.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's very important to realize also that the stereotypical firstborn, and this is a stereotype, so not all kids fit this, but they are more often than not pleasers. And there's this dynamic that happens where that it's, you know, personality plays in big time as well. But by and large, when that dynamic exists and they're alone in your company for the first however many years and all those imprints are being made, who do they want to impress? You? Who are you focused on them? That there's a tremendous amount of really interesting writing about birth order that plays out in a lot of homes for good reason. Right? Yeah. It's just, it makes good sense why your firstborn is in conversation with you a little bit more.
And I think with the ones who don't talk as much, who aren't the reporters in the household, who aren't the, you know, inquisitive types, those kids, speaking of resourcefulness and creativity, like you have to find other ways in. It doesn't mean they don't want the information. It doesn't mean they're not wondering about a lot of this stuff. But for whatever reason, they're not going to initiate conversation. They're also not going to necessarily tell you what's going on. I mean, I'll give you a perfect example. So I have four kids. Three are very chatty and one is more quiet. And the quieter one, I realized after having recorded a episode of our podcast about pornography that he was, I think, 15 at the time that I hadn't had a conversation with him about pornography in a while. So we were on vacation and we we're sitting in lounge chairs, drinking our, you know, virgin pina coladas. And I was relaxed and he was relaxed. And I was like, hey, you know what? I realize we haven't talked about porn in a while. And like, I'm just curious, like, what, you know, what's the latest on that? What are people talking about with that? And we had the best conversation. And it was like, somebody said to me, talk to your teenage son about porn while you're on vacation, sitting by a pool in lounge chairs, drinking pina coladas. I would have been like, no way. That's never going to work. Like, that's a ridiculous suggestion. But with some kids, like, you don't know. Sometimes, like, really unexpected settings and approaches are really effective. Yeah. And they need that, like, super calm, relaxed environment. So, yeah. Don't prejudge. Be open to, like, unexpected ways into these conversations with kids. And you can also laugh about it. Like, we were literally laughing about it. He's like, oh, my God, Mom, I can't believe we're sitting here talking about porn while, like, putting sunscreen on and watching kids in the pool. And I was like, yeah, it's pretty funny, right? And he's like, yeah, it's really funny. So enjoy the humor of it all, and make sure kids know that they're allowed to find it all funny.
Yeah. Like, we can all kind of laugh. Yeah.
Yeah, because that makes for great conversations.
So I had all these topics to get to before porn, but...
Why wait?
That's our philosophy towards porn. Why wait?
Since you brought it up. This is probably, and I know I'm not alone, like, I don't want to talk about this, and... I have somewhat with my oldest to follow the pattern, but you point out the average age for a first porn viewing is 12 for boys and not much later for girls, and 15% of kids say their first exposure was at age 10. So I think that's really important to pull out. And so, for example, I really don't want to bring this up with my son. Do I just tell his father to do it, or how would you counsel me?
Oh, I would get harsh. Are you okay with me getting harsh?
Yes,
I mean,
please.
I want to be warm and inclusive and loving when I get harsh, but I'm going to get harsh. Let's ditch the gendering of this conversation.
Okay. Yes.
One way we say it is we don't let anyone off the hook on any of these conversations. The other more positive way of saying is you have the opportunity to have this conversation with all of your children, regardless of their body parts. And frankly, Vanessa answered a question when we were on the road with our book. This question came up in so many different ways. And one of the ways she answered it, I wanted to record it and just put it out as a TikTok because it was so brilliant. She said, do you have two adults in a home? If you're lucky enough to have two adults in a home, and only one of them is the go-to person about this, that says everything.
Yeah.
It tells it, it speaks volumes to your kid. It shuts off certain spigots of a relationship for you. It talks about discomfort and therefore limits trust. I mean, like, no, go there. But you can go there in the way that feels authentic to you. And it might sound like this. I'm so nervous to have this conversation with you. I've actually felt a little bit more comfortable having this conversation with your sisters because we share the same gender. For some reason, that is stressing me out with you, and my heart is pounding and my palms are sweating, but I'm here and I'm going to do it. And your dad's going to have this conversation with you too. That does not mean you're only going to have this conversation once, but here's what I want to say. And then say your one or two lines and then say, and now I'm just going to shut my trap and listen to what you have to say.
Great.
And I think, you know, for some people talking about like sexual logistics is easier, right? Like body parts and whatever. And for some people, the emotional side, like one of the things we really want people to remember to talk to their kids about is that sex should involve love and communication and laughter and connection. And so like the first porn conversation may have nothing to do with porn. It may just say something like, hey, kiddo, I know you're just a kid, but I keep thinking about what your life is going to be like when you get older and you become an adult. And I know we don't talk about this that often, but like, I hope when you grow up, you find someone you really love and you really feel connected to, and they feel really connected to you, and you get to be in a relationship that feels like really meaningful, right? That right. may actually be the first porn conversation.
Yeah.
Because right. then they know, oh, this is what my parent really wants for me. But somebody showed me something on the mm-hmm. bus, and it was somebody being violent and aggressive mm-hmm. and not loving and not respectful to the person that they were having sex with. And so I know that that's not actually what my parents hoped for me, right?
Right.
And so, like, start there, and then you can have the other conversations, right? Like, it should be consensual, that, you know, that their people's bodies in porn aren't like normally what normal yeah. people's bodies look like. That when you're intimate with someone else, you should have permission and they should ask your permission. You know, those, you can then have those conversations, but sometimes the like gentle way in is easier for people. And again, like you are laying a huge and deep foundation for your kids about what their future relationships look like. And that's going to be created by a million tiny conversations over time.
Right. And as they're getting older and their general social life is changing, the conversations change as well. So,
for sure.
But I really like that entry point around relationships in general and health, what's a healthy relationship and how that's what we hope for them. I actually want to circle back to Kara's harsh challenge. Because it made me think, and this is all in the moment, how much parents are affected by the social messaging around gender and how we bring that into our parenting. Even those of us who are very open-minded and accepting, it's still there, mm-hmm. right? I mean, there's still that, like, I can see how it will infiltrate how we talk to our kids. And so how we really need to be mindful and careful of that.
Yeah. I mean, so often people say to us, like, I didn't grow up talking about this. I didn't grow up in a household where any adult talked to me about it.
Yeah.
I didn't know these things about my body or my transformation until I was like well into adulthood. And so one thing we really like to reassure people is that you don't have to have grown up having these conversations, knowing these things, feeling comfortable. We are all capable of change and transformation in our own ways. We are all capable of educating ourselves and growing our knowledge. I mean, honestly, that is why we wrote the book, because kids who have adults who have educated themselves and are willing to have these conversations with them, those kids are safer.
Yeah.
They are safer and they are healthier, full yep. stop. And so people love their kids more than anything else in the world. They love them more than their own discomfort. They love them more than their own perceived ignorance. And so we will do anything to keep our kids healthy and safe. And that also means getting over the really uncomfortable reality of having tough conversations. I mean, my husband is English. When I say he did not grow up in these conversations, that is an understatement of the century. He has amazing, loving, incredible parents, but he grew up in a society where you didn't talk about it. And if you did, dads talked to sons and moms yep. talked to daughters. But as Kara said earlier, like our kids often were flavor of the month, right? Like one month they feel really close to one parent. The yeah. next month, they feel close to the other parent, and the first parent is like persona non grata, you know. And if only one parent has a connection with a kid, that means when there's a divide or a schism or whatever, that kid is left without that connection to that other adult. And so we really, really, really want people to move past their discomfort and their socialization.
Yep.
Right? Like the socialization. The sexualization of girls, that's a really tough one. The toxic masculinity for boys, that's a really tough one. The body image expectations and issues around weight and size, that's a huge one, right? Like those are really, really, really heavy socialization and societal expectations, but it is time for us to unburden ourselves of those things.
They're very constraining of each person's experience.
And they're very harmful.
Yeah.
And they're it doesn't mean it's easy. I don't say that because I've like unchained myself from all of these things, right? We are all victims of this. And yet they create a narrative for our kids that is not healthy.
Helpful.
And it's not helpful.
Yeah.
And I think parents are afraid of getting it wrong.
Yeah.
Because if with no modeling of how to do it right, I think sometimes we very understandably say, well, I don't want to get it wrong. So I'd rather do nothing than do something wrong. I think nothing is something wrong.
Right. Yep. That's a really good point. So we were talking earlier about moods, and I think that's a really important topic to hit on is mood swings.
I could imitate a 13-year-old right now and ask why you think it's such an important topic, but I won't.
So let's start with the brain. I found this really interesting. So tell us why teens in puberty feel emotions differently than we do as adults.
I mean, to get deep into the science of it, I will point you to the chapter in the book. Actually, there are a number of chapters that explain the hormonal looping. So I won't explain all of that. That happens that actually makes puberty as a process, kickstarts it and gets it rolling. But I will jump into the middle of that explanation and to say, were puberty a slow, steady rise in sex hormones that our bodies and our brains could adjust to over time, it would be a very gentle process or far less friction filled than it is now. But it is not a slow, steady rise. It is a jerking car that's accelerating and then braking and then accelerating, braking. It is rises and falls in hormone levels that go all in and around the body and also in and around the brain. Those hormones deeply impacting the way neurons fire and the way we feel. And of course, every adult who hears this explanation and thinks about the high highs and the low lows of hormones can relate because they know what it feels like to have a hormonal mood swing. We still have them, right? Yeah. But a couple of caveats. One is their hormonal mood swings are more intense because their hormonal highs are much higher than anything we can generate right now. I mean, maybe you can generate. I cannot generate hormone highs the way I can do the lows. Yeah, I've got that mastered. But so the delta between the highs and the lows is much bigger for kids. And the other is, their brains are not used to it. Yeah. Our brains are. We know we can feel it coming. We can anticipate it and we can help guide ourselves. No can do if you're a tween and you don't understand what you're feeling.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when we go out and we speak, when we write, when we make TikToks, the message is the same across all of it, which is, I'm going to quote one of our favorite therapist who has a podcast called Raising Good Humans. Her name is Aliza Pressman. And Aliza says, all feelings are welcome. All behaviors are not.
Yep.
You can have the mood swings and not quite know how to handle it, but we've got to rein in the behavior because there are real consequences to that behavior.
Yeah.
And so that becomes the question.
Well, and that's really the learning process for them to build competence around managing.
And I think part of that is recognizing that they feel shame when they have these mood swings.
Yes.
And they feel lonely when they have these mood swings and confused and embarrassed, right? Like they're not choosing to ride this hormonal roller coaster. It's happening to them. Right. And the downstream behavior because of the mood swings, they don't feel good about that behavior. And so in order to help them manage it, the first step is being like, wow, that was a lot. What did that feel like for you? And often they'll say like, oh, it felt awful. Like I was so angry and I didn't even know why I was so angry. And then I said that thing and then I felt awful about saying that thing, right? So like giving them an opportunity, I mean, listen, you're the psychologist, but like giving them the opportunity and the skill of being able to unpack what they went through in a quiet moment, not like just on the heels of the actual, you know, dramatic mood swing, is a really great thing. Because honestly, I mean, I'm 47. I've had my period for like almost 35 years. And still to this day, there's a day every month where I look at my family and I'm like, oh, I hate all of you. And I still, 35 years later, I'm like, oh, right, I'm getting my period, but I don't realize it. I now have the skill, like at least a little sooner to recognize it. But like helping kids make that recognition, I just think removes the shame and just helps them like feel more constructive about it.
Well, and really removing that shame is really at the core of developing emotional health and resilience. And one reason I loved this chapter so much is because I'm a psychologist and all about emotions. And you do offer a lot of strategies. And one of them is this empathy piece and how important that is. And I just wanted to pull out a quote that kind of underlines what you were just saying, Vanessa, but it really got my attention. Keep in mind that kids feel pretty powerless when they're at the mercy of their hormones. They don't like being exceedingly unpleasant or unreachable either. Your best move here is to offer up empathy. It feels bad.
Yeah. Can I just thank you? It means everything to us when pros in the mental health world like what we have to say about mental health. So huge thanks for that. But yeah, that empathy piece, it doesn't mean that you have to like the way they're behaving, and it doesn't mean that you even understand what they're feeling.
Yeah.
Vanessa will often talk about how our reaction as adults is so often, it's not a big deal. But to them, whatever it is a very big deal. And the hormones that are coursing through their brain make it an even bigger deal.
Yeah.
And so just some empathy, even if you're screaming inside your own head, what you're verbalizing is, okay, I hear you. I see you. I feel you. I'm so sorry. It sounds really crummy. Or as Vanessa would say, that sucks.
Yeah. Well, and you list some really fabulous strategies. And one of my favorites that you talk about is show them a way out. Mm. Can you say more about that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when the kids are younger and they're like tantruming, and it's like they just feel like they can't get out of it. And if like if we flip out with a tantruming little kid, it just makes it worse.
Yeah.
And with mood swings, it's like that. And it's worse because they have language that they can use, like weapons, and they have physical presence and space that they can use in kind of more dramatic and unpleasant ways, right? Like everything just feels more when they're mood swinging, you know, the equivalent of a tantrum. So, I mean, obviously, this is advice you must give a million times a day, right? They need to breathe.
Yep.
And, but if you say to a 13-year-old, take a deep breath, they will literally shoot down.
Vanessa, do it. Do your imitation.
Oh, if you say to a 13-year-old, take a deep breath, they'll be like, I hate it when you tell me to take a deep breath. I don't want to take a deep breath. I'm not taking a deep breath. And so, but you know you can co-regulate, right? So you take a deep breath.
Right.
And at the very least, it makes us feel better. One of the talks we gave, a parent said, when I breathe in front of my kid, literally, these were her words, when I breathe in front of my kid gets mad at me for breathing.
That and sounds I'm
like,
about right.
I'm like, okay, fair. Like, that's totally age appropriate. And you should remind them that is like not only your right to breathe, but it is like a biological necessity for you to breathe.
Yeah.
So like they've got to like deal with their hatred of you breathing.
Vanessa also, she does this thing where she pairs empathy with her breath, where she goes like this. She goes, oh. But someone at one of our talks said, they said, that makes it sound like you think your kid is a jerk. which I found very funny because I always thought it was such a great strategy. So as Vanessa now says in the talk, so this is what I do, but you do you.
Right. And also they didn't use the word jerk.
No, they did not. No. But again, you know, one of us may be the PG voice and one of us may be. You know.
And I might have repeated the word they did use a couple of talks until I was like, her and I were like, maybe that's not so appropriate to repeat the language.
So jerk it is.
So jerk it is. But also, like, people feel like they need to talk. Like, let's talk it out. Like, oh, let's sit down and talk for 4 hours. And the kid is like, the last thing I want to do right now is talk it out.
Yeah.
And so we really encourage parents to just, like, pivot. Just, like, find another way, right? Like, hey, I got to walk the dog. Let's walk the dog. Or let's get a glass of water because I'm dehydrated and you've had a long day. Let's get a glass of water. Or, and I do try this and it doesn't work in my house, but maybe there's someone listening for whom it will work. I'll say to my kids like, hey, do you want to braid my hair? And they're like, no, like, ew. But also I've redirected them and I've distracted them and I've maybe even made them laugh a little bit. So I think there's this feeling of like, if a mood swing is happening, we have to engage, right? Like, let's solve it. Let's fix it right now. But the truth is showing them a way out is actually by like not engaging in it and just being there and being loving and non-judgmental and not relitigating what just happened, right? The temptation is like, well, you're upset, but really what happened is like, it's your fault. I mean, I'd like to joke when the kid comes home and is like railing against the injustice of the world because they failed a Spanish test.
Right.
And like, the teacher hates me and like the school is the worst.
Everyone else's fault.
Everyone else's fault. And in your head, you're like, dude, if you had studied for your Spanish test, you would not have failed your Spanish test. But like, what good does that do? That doesn't do anyone any good. So what do you say? Like, oh, yeah, that sucks. I mean, I'm really sorry. And I do quote Lisa DeMoor because Lisa DeMoor says that stinks. But Lisa's so much more refined than I am. So I don't say that stinks. I say that sucks. But like everyone will find. And then I said to Cara's son while we were on the book tour, I was like, what are you like? What's the LA equivalent of like that sucks? And he was like, that sucks. And I said, great. Perfect.
Going with it.
Maybe you run in Cleveland, but in New York and LA, we can say that sucks. But everyone will find their language. And it just, I mean, it just affirms that it's okay that they're, you know, that they're not, they haven't created an unsolvable problem that they can never get out of.
Well, right. Because then if they feel like their reaction in that moment has hurt you as the parent or alienated you as the parent, then they have that to manage on top of the original trigger.
That's exactly right.
Yes.
And then they're buried.
Yes.
So I've also learned the power of food with teenagers, right? And sometimes hunger can be a major culprit of these big moods. And so sometimes that reconnecting after a big outburst can be around, let's have some food together.
Yeah, I mean, we have a friend, Dolly Clock, who is a family medicine doctor in LA, and she's a wonderful organization called Adolescence, and she does all sorts of workshops and stuff. And she does this thing, I think it's on Sunday mornings in her house, where it's like, I don't know, that she makes like chocolate chip pancakes every Sunday morning. And she does it because her kids gather. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't do it in reaction to a mood swing. She does it. It's more of like a prophylactic tool, which is like, it's a way for her to connect with her kids and kind of get a sense of like where they are and how their week was. And food is the lure.
Yeah.
And is the gathering point. And it's such a lovely idea.
But they've been conditioned to talk, right? So what she recognizes is there's a pattern where this is the forum where they get into interesting conversations. And so they're going to frame shift into that more open sharing type mode when all of these visual and tactile and olfactory things are being triggered at once. So for her, I mean, like I would love to see this experiment. Like, you hand her kids pancakes and do they open up in, you know, different circumstances. But you can imagine that just, it's like, it, there's a constellation of things that happens that just now they can get there faster each time. And frankly, I mean, she talks about this. It doesn't always work.
Right.
And that's the other thing. Like, something might work on a Monday and by Tuesday, it's like, oh, forget about it. And then you try it again a week later and yep, it's okay. So, you know, I don't know, Vanessa, you know, you want to walk through that one a little bit?
Well, it's interesting. I was thinking about the food in response to a mood, like to an explosion. And I was walking through in my mind, what is it about that activity? So A, yes, if they're hungry, their reactions are going to be like doubly challenging.
Right.
And Kara actually is no longer an adolescent, but when she gets hungry, like, watch out, like, you got it.
Yeah.
You have no idea.
It's like,
yeah,
it's
I'm the same.
But I was thinking about, what are the elements with kids that make it so effective? So part of it is, you know, dealing with the hunger. Part of it is it's something they enjoy. But also I'm thinking about, like, if you're prepping food, you're not making eye contact, right? Like, you're just
parallel
play and you're in the same space, but you're not looking at each other. And you're busy. Your mind can rest because it's busy doing a mundane task that feels familiar, like chopping onions or filling a water pitcher, or, you know, toasting something, right? And like, I was thinking about, what are the kind of automated things we can do that allow our minds to come down from something? Mm-hmm. And then also, when you feed a kid, right, it's a gesture of love. And I know all the time people say, like, don't reward with food and don't bribe with food. And I just don't agree with that. I think there's something really loving and caring about feeding a child. And like, I mean, there's this really funny story where my quiet kid, my number two, was having a tough time one week and I realized he needed extra attention. And I picked him up from the bus and I brought him up, you know, those little packs of Oreos, and I walked him to soccer practice and I stayed and watched soccer practice. And that was like a few things I never normally do. And he looked at me and he goes, literally after that one afternoon, he looked at me, he goes, what's going on? Like, why are you doing all this? And I was like, and it was Oreos and watching soccer practice, right? I didn't throw a parade.
We didn't acts.
We didn't go to Hawaii. Like, it was tiny acts. And I said, you know, I just felt like you were getting lost. Yeah. And I needed to, like, just connect with you and do some special things. And he was like, thank you.
The other thing about food that I think is important to mention, two things. One is, it's primal. You're meeting a need.
Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe the Oreos aren't primal, but you're meeting, but the Oreos bring up another feature of food, which is really important, which is there's pleasure.
Yes.
And, what do we do when something big happens? We often celebrate with food.
Yeah.
What kind of food do we celebrate with? Food that feels indulgent, food that maybe we don't always eat, food that feels like a treat. You know, like, there's a lot of science there. There's a lot that... It just makes sense then that having conversations when you're either meeting a primal need or you're pairing it with something that feels special and different, it just, you know, it just makes good common sense.
Well, it's very connecting.
Yeah.
And that's what we're going for in all of this.
When my kid found out that there was like tons of research about the benefit of eating chocolate, he was like, oh my God, why didn't anyone tell me?
Okay. Real story. We're in LA, we're like on talk number 30 something. And we've gotten it down to such a science that it's a morning talk and we meet one of our hosts at the school where we're giving the talk, take a little walk for about a half an hour to clear our minds. And there's no coffee to be found anywhere nearby, but there's a Trader Joe's. And so we go to the Trader Joe's, and Vanessa, who has never been in this Trader Joe's or in this part of town of Los Angeles, knows, she says, oh, we're going to get you Takis, because I'd never had the Takis, the Trader Joe version. And she found the aisle within, I'm not exaggerating, 9 seconds. And because she knows her way around Trader Joe's, and I bought 2 bags and she's like, you need 2 more. And I buy 2 more. And I'm like, but I've never had these. We don't know if we like these. And she was like, no, we like these. So I said, okay. And we buy these Takis, put them in my car. And then later that day, they just end up in my pantry on the shelf. Fine. So I don't know if you know this story, Vanessa. So my son comes home from school, opens the cupboard, and he's like, what's the deal with the Takis? Why do we have Takis? By the way, this will not shock you that my house is not packed with a whole lot of really fun food. Okay. And I said, oh, because Vanessa loves them. And she said, every kid loves them and you would love them and I would love them. And so, and he's like, well, first of all, there are 4 bags and that's a lot. And second of all, no, I don't like them. I was like, okay, fine. My daughter comes home from college and we're hanging out the night she comes home, having great bonding, whatever. She goes to bed. I go to bed, wake up the next morning. I find her in the kitchen with the bag of Takis. And she's like, who bought me Takis? I love whoever. These are my favorite. And I was like, that, right? Like that was a moment. And yeah. I gave Vanessa the cred. I did not give myself the cred, but she felt seen. Mm-hmm. She felt valued. There was, right? I mean, and that is, it's a bag of chips.
Yeah. But it's everything. I know. Everything.
Yes.
You know, and my book is about autonomy, supportive parenting. And the whole big picture of that is raising a child who has an authentic sense of self. Mm-hmm. And what that requires is that they feel seen and understood by their parent.
And the tricky part in this stage of life is that who they see themselves as evolves and it changes. And
it's so confusing.
It's confusing for them and it's confusing for the adults because they're like,
yes,
I thought I was getting it right, but now my kid is letting me know I'm not getting it right anymore. And I have to like figure out how to get it right again. And I do think, I mean, you tell us, but I do think acknowledging to a kid like, hey, listen, I am trying really hard to like use the right language here or be interested in what you're interested in. But I feel like I keep messing it up. And can you help me? Like, can you let me know what pronouns to use or how to talk about fantasy football or like the talk about the YouTube makeup tutorials, like whatever it is they're interested in.
Or do you like Takis?
Or is the answer to every question Trader Joe's Takis? And
I think so. I think that's where we've landed. This is the solution to puberty.
Take a do-over and eat some Takis. I feel like that's where we've landed.
Those are actually my 14-year-old's favorite. So you really hit on something there. And I don't stock them. And if I ever get some, it feels very special.
Yeah. So. And they're gone.
I have a couple of extra bags. Yeah.
So this has been such a pleasure. And I had like paragraphs more to go over. So people will just need to get the book if they haven't already. But so many important components. I wanted to talk about sleep, more about sex, growth, like how the bodies are changing during puberty and how to talk about that with our kids in helpful, constructive ways.
We'll come back.
Good. We need a part two.
Yes.
There's so much. So one of the things you do best in this book that I really want to point out is the strategies part. I mean, parents will read this or caregivers will read this and they will feel guided. So it is so helpful. I have this vision of me sitting next to my child on the roller coaster, right? We're side by side. We're in it together. Sometimes we scream, sometimes we laugh, but we're side by side. So thank you so much for your time today. Your book, This Is So Awkward, Modern Puberty Explained, should be on every parent's bookshelf. It's a wealth of knowledge, including the biology I never learned, and concrete practical tips for parents to help us talk to our kids again and again and again. I do love that throughout your book, you give us these pointers on what to say while also preparing us for the responses we might get in the moment, like eyes rolling, and your encouragement that it's okay to flounder and make mistakes. The point is to keep trying. So thank you for this puberty Bible. Where can people find you and learn more about your work?
First of all, thank you. That is so lovely and exactly what we hoped people would feel. And a trained mental health professional saying it makes it even more meaningful. So really, really so much gratitude. People can find us besides at This Is So Awkward with the book, Spilling the Puberty, T-E-A, on TikTok and Instagram, and the Puberty Podcast, where we talk about all the many things in the book and beyond. And they can also find us on our website, modernpuberty.com.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was
Thank
a joy.
You.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock. If you enjoy our podcast, you can help us out by leaving a review or contributing on Patreon.
You can get more psychology tips by subscribing to our newsletter and connecting with us on social media.
We'd like to thank our podcast production manager, Chadine Stout-Williams.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not meant to be a substitute for mental health treatment. If you're looking for mental health treatment, please visit the resources page of our website, offtheclockpsych.com.